Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome back to New Books in History. I'm your host, Sam Backer. I'm a PhD candidate in history at Johns Hopkins University in Baltimore. And I'm here today with David Minot, who published a wonderful new book, Vaudeville and the Making of Modern Entertainment, 1890 to 1925. So first off, congratulations, David.
Thank you, Sam. And it's delightful to be here with you.
So just to get started, I'm wondering if you could tell us a little bit about how you came to this project.
Mm-hmm. Actually, in a very circuitous way, I had started off doing some work on the blues, about 15 years ago, I suppose. And it was about the same time that others were beginning to question the traditional approach that had been taken to the origins of the blues, the country origins in particular, and we're beginning to look at the historical record and discover that the earliest accounts we have of the blues were in the theater, and that led me to start working on Black popular theater. And its links to the blues. There has been some great work done on that since I started on that work, and I did a preliminary article and then realized that other people were doing much better work than I was. But I became interested in vaudeville generally from that work, and I started doing research on that probably about 12 years ago or 13 years ago. And wrote my first chapter, and you will understand this as somebody in the process of writing. The first chapter grew bigger and bigger and bigger and turned into a first book on pre-vaudeville popular theater. And this one is very much a second book on vaudeville itself and modern entertainment. So it really grew out of some early interest I had in music and in popular music.
Oh, that's absolutely fascinating, and I totally, especially in this period of time, all the entertainment forms are so linked, and mm-hmm. the histories go back in some ways so quickly, almost mm-hmm. that I totally understand the wanting to start maybe in 1890 and realizing that to do that you needed to start in 1800.
Yeah. That's exactly the case. And I started reading back into concert saloons, which, as you know, have not been particularly well researched. And what interests me at reading the book, I'm very interested in the aesthetics of popular theater, how performers presented themselves, what the culture of the theater experience itself was. I tried to understand the concert saloon in the context of the broader popular theater and in the context of sentimentality in the 19th century as a critique and also in some ways a negation of the sentimental popular theater of that time. And so that kind of grew into my last book, which was The Soul of Pleasure, and deals with sentimentality, the popular theater, concert saloons, and the way in which entertainment was changing over the course of the 19th century. And it took me up very much to the 1890s. And then this book takes the next place. But there's not going to be a trilogy. So
for those listeners who may not have really thought about vaudeville past kind of this, I've always felt that it holds kind of a funny place in our collective memory. It's uh-huh. It's the thing right before the beginning of the thing at a certain level.
Yep.
Like right before the Marx Brothers, right before the earliest films most people know mm-hmm. is vaudeville and the kind of vaudeville aesthetics. I'm just wondering if you could tell us a little bit about what vaudeville was and how big and how new it was at the time.
Yep, sure. It's a very old. Vaudeville is both a type of entertainment and a way of selling that entertainment. So why don't I separate those two a little bit? The type of entertainment itself is sometimes called or often called vaudeville, but it really should be called variety, and it's much older. Dates back to the early 19th century in the United States. And it is a form of entertainment in which different actors perform short acts, which are isolated from each other. So there's no continuity, there's no storyline, they're not sequential in any logical format, even though the people who put on those acts try and organize them in a way to create excitement over the course of the evening of entertainment. So vaudeville as a type of entertainment, meaning the variety show, is very old and it's still around today. And so vaudeville as a organizational form had a relatively brief history in the longer history of variety entertainment. It was a way of delivering variety entertainment that existed in its heyday, which is the period I'm covering, probably about 25 or 30 years. Vaudeville itself, as a form of delivering variety entertainment, was a network of theaters that existed across the United States and Canada. There were at its peak probably 1,500 to 2,000 vaudeville theaters. There were maybe 20 to 30,000 vaudeville performers who traveled from one theater to another at any one time. And about 5 million Americans attended weekly to see an evening of vaudeville entertainment. And so it was an organizational form that depended on the movement of the performer from theater to theater. So in a sense, it is bound by the earlier technology. Film moves the product, right? In a different sort of way, you can ship it from place to place. In a pre-film era, you have to move the performers. So you can't have synchronous performance. You can't have the same actor performing in two different places at the same time, whereas you could have a film screened in thousands of different places in the same minute. But the principle was the same, that you would have performers moving around from theater to theater across the country. And because the theaters themselves were trying to secure performers, and there was competition for the best performers, theaters found that by grouping together into networks or chains of theaters, they could move performers through the links in the chain. And that would guarantee the performers a certain number of weeks of performance. So you would measure your contract by the number of weeks you had. Short jumps were preferred to long jumps, so that the shorter your travel between theaters, if you could perform in different theaters on different nights, that was preferable because your income was more steady. And that then led to the creation of this kind of distribution network. And that distribution network becomes the basis of film distribution, so that Fox theaters, for example, were vaudeville theaters that convert over to film theaters. So many of the early vaudeville theaters then become chains of film theaters. So I think that's what its distinctive features are. I think the most distinctive feature of it was the distribution system, because that distribution system was very new. The idea of having regional and then national chains of theaters that would move performers through them meant that people in widely disparate parts of the United States could see the same things on different nights. And so for many historians before I started working on this, it was part of the creation of a national entertainment culture, because people in New York or Duluth would actually see the same actors on different nights, different weeks, but they'd see the same people, hear the same music, listen to the same jokes. And so you are creating a national entertainment culture. And vaudeville was really the first to do that.
And my understanding is it's also groundbreaking in the expanse of its audience. I mean, I'm thinking about, you know, the theatrical syndicate, which is moving, quote unquote, legitimate theatrical productions at a national level. But those are, you know, the least a ticket is going to be is 25 cents. And one of the key innovations of vaudeville is that the least a ticket's going to be is what, 10, which puts it in the reach of a far larger swath of the population.
Yeah, and you've hit on one of the great debates about vaudeville, as you know. You know, to what extent it is a working class entertainment or an entertainment of the less well off. I don't argue that. I argue that it appeals to a wide cross section of Americans, and that certainly in big cities, you find vaudeville theaters in well-to-do neighborhoods and less well-to-do neighborhoods, and that it seemed to have been able to touch people from a wide variety of economic, ethnic, and racial backgrounds.
So the title of the book is Vaudeville and the Making of Modern Entertainment. Mm-hmm. And I think one of the key arguments that you lay out here is that vaudeville and the popularity of vaudeville is intimately caught up with the kind of experience of an experience and exploration, maybe, of a new kind of modernity in the United States and Canada. And I'm wondering if you could talk about that a little bit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm going to speak in duos today. So there's, again, kind of two aspects of this. The first aspect of why I argue that it is a modern entertainment hinges on this distribution system, but also, as you point out, the idea that it's cheap, but more than being inexpensive, that it is meant to be taken casually, so that you're not preparing yourself for an evening of the theater. People would go out to vaudeville and enter the show halfway through. They'd walk out when they came to a part they didn't like. They'd leave. They'd come back. It was a very casual entertainment experience. And the other argument that I make about this is that it was the first entertainment that I believe was designed to help people who are exhausted from a day recharge. So it was light and it was frivolous, and they tended not to put on acts that would cause intense emotion, sometimes fear, but often that was regarded unfavorably by managers if they tried to scare their audience too much. So the idea was to keep people happy, to keep people lighthearted, to keep people entertained, and to turn entertainment into a form of emotional rehabilitation after a tiring day at work or in the city. And so that's one aspect of modernity. And I think you still see that carrying through in the entertainment culture of movies and in the entertainment culture of television, which both have this kind of recharging aspect to it, that we're supposed to relax when we watch these things and kind of turn our minds off. So that's one aspect of it. The other one is the content, again. And the content itself is, as you say, I play with the notion of modernity, that what vaudeville, and of course, it's a vast entertainment, right? There's thousands and thousands of acts. So this is a generalization, and I have no doubt that people will find lots of acts that don't fit these models. But the idea was to sell the new as better. Modern life is better than previous forms of life, so that characters who are old-fashioned, whether they're immigrants or the Rube character, the rural character, are projected in a comic negative light, and vaudeville celebrates the smart, fast-talking, cynical, well-dressed urbanite, and it develops its own way of speaking, which is called Broadway slang, and its own way of moving, its own way of presenting people, and its own attitudes to life, so that the great butt of vaudeville jokes, the mother-in-law, becomes a kind of symbol of everything that's old-fashioned, and vaudeville looks forward to people overcoming the conservatism of their mothers-in-laws. And so that's very much the other aspect of this, that it sells modernity both in the entertainment culture and in the entertainment content.
And no, that's a really fascinating point, because nostalgia and sentimentality had been maybe not the dominant strand, but a major strand of American entertainment culture, certainly through the 19th century. And you're saying that vaudeville really pushes back against that in a distinctive and kind of almost like a flag-planting way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's true. As we know, a lot of the content is, by our measure, deeply sentimental. But it's a different type of sentimentality. If we think of 19th century sentimentality in terms of empathy, right? It's the Christian value of being able to feel yourself in the position of the suffering other. That's not the sentimentality that vaudeville presents. Vaudeville sentimentality is more of the 20th century cloying type, rather than that notion that it's a positive value to be able to experience the suffering of others because it makes you a better Christian. So this isn't the 19th century world. This is very much a 20th century form of the sentimental. Sentimentality has a fascinating history. I mean, we tend to think of it as one thing, but it's evolved a great deal since the 18th century.
So kind of picking up on the idea of a 20th century way of being, another thing that kind of comes out of that that you talk about is vaudeville's relationship to ideas of personality, and in particular, the development of a specific type of stardom. Yeah. Related to those ideas of personality that even though it's happening just before film really lays the foundation and is one of the first places where you can see a certain type of stardom, a certain type of celebrity culture that becomes just incredibly influential in American life going forward.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think, as you say, vaudeville presages that. And it's a simpler, more personal form. It certainly doesn't have the same glitz that surrounds the studio system. But vaudeville entertainers advertise products. Their faces appear on cigarette cartons and cosmetics. They sell clothing. They will draw attention to the makers of the clothes they wear. They give interviews before shows talking about their clothes, talking about the cosmetics they use, talking about the exercise and fitness routines that they engage in, the food that they eat. And early on, until 1905, you could actually have advertising featured on the stage so that you could have products, product advertising directly as part of your act. And the managers, the vaudeville managers get away, move stars away from that. But so there's product, there's brand identification. You see this also with sheet music, which is a huge industry. Increasingly in the 1890s, as vaudeville becomes bigger, the faces of the performers are now featured on the cover of the sheet music. So that too is a kind of branding and a marketing of the performer. So it does start this process of identifying stars with a rich lifestyle. And they also do an awful lot to promote themselves. And in the book, I'm skeptical about the truth of these things, but the performers always present themselves as having a rags to riches lifestyle, that they started out just as humble folk who are now earning fabulous salaries and are nationally or internationally famous. So that too is part of the modernizing, democratizing influence of vaudeville, this notion that anybody could make it, that you too, if you have talent or you have personality or if you have chutzpah, you can be a star and you can make a fortune. And that's part of the culture of the theater itself. And they do become models, role models for behavior in a way that, the actors of the sentimental theater don't. I don't think people looked at Edwin Booth and thought, I want to act like Booth, but you would see a vaudeville performer and think, I'm going to dress like that person. I'm going to use their cosmetics. I'm going to follow their exercise routine. I'm going to read about them in fan magazines. It is on a much smaller scale than film, which in part because the studios take on the marketing of these people in ways that vaudeville theaters never managed to effectively market the people who work for them. But it's the start. It's the start of the process. And as you know, for historians, always one of our difficulties is when you're dealing with these continuums, it's always a case of where do you start and how do you rank this as more important or less important, bigger or less big, whatever it might be, with the things that went before it and after it, right? So it's not on a scale with film, but it's on a scale.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com. newbooks.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
In one of my favorite footnotes, Stuart Blumen in the making of his book about the making of the middle class coined something called Blumen's rule, which is, it happened in my period.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
So, but in addition, I mean, you write about to this kind of broader structure around stardom on the vaudeville stage. You also write really compellingly about the ways in which, in some ways, the performance dynamics and the underlying aesthetics that occurred very much on the vaudeville stage also kind of complemented that emergence of celebrity and stardom. This idea that, unlike, let's say, Edwin Booth, for instance, the great late 19th century actor who is himself a public personality but is not playing Edwin Booth exactly on stage, that the vaudeville stars are presenting themselves doing things on stage. That you write that it's both entirely authentic and entirely artificial, and that what they're doing is artificial, but they are being authentically themselves doing these artificial things. And that seems to mark a real change in the relationship, in understanding conceptualizations of identity, maybe, on the stage and in a performance culture.
Yeah, I think so. It is a theater of authenticity. People perform, they're performers, right? I don't think we should forget that. And they come on stage performing a role, and they do it more or less effectively. But the pretense of performance is that they're not performing, that somehow they are just ordinary people who have a great voice or a particular skill. And they draw attention to themselves as people rather than to the work that they're performing. So that while it's true that the song may become a hit and people will take up performing it, part of the goal is to have that song identified with a particular performer or a particular style of performance, to draw attention to the person. And I know I'm wandering into ground that's probably beyond me here, but I trace a kind of change in the nature of popular song to an increasing attention to making them personal. That 19th century sentimental song is often telling stories, whereas 20th century popular song is about what happened to you, your experience of love, your hardships, your heartbreak. And it's about the singer and the identification of singer and song. And that is part of a vaudeville characteristic of drawing attention to the individual who is on stage playing themselves. So it is totally artificial, right? You're coming out on stage, you're being announced on a board that you're coming out at 10 after 8. You're on stage for 15 minutes and then you leave and somebody else comes out after you. So it's a very artificial environment. It's hard when watching that not to be aware of the theater itself, particularly in a place where the house lights are kept dim but not off, where people are getting up and moving around during the show or talking during the show. So you're always aware, you would be if you're in a vaudeville theater, of the environment, the theatrical environment. But the trick for the performer is to create that bond between themselves and the audience, where the audience member sees their personality as the thing that is attracting attention, rather than necessarily the content of what they're doing. And that is, to my mind, new, and it's very much there in film with the big stars and how they develop it. Though vaudeville's different in some ways. That direct appeal to the audience, the habit of talking to the audience, which is also part of naturalizing the vaudeville environment, Of course, it doesn't work in film. I mean, the Marx Brothers try it, or, you know, sometimes there's an aside where the actor will address the audience in a movie, but it's not terribly common, whereas it was very common in the vaudeville theater as part of creating this natural environment in which you felt you were just looking at ordinary people being themselves. I think you see it very clearly in Magic. And it's one of the things that interested me a great deal in the book. And I the section I have on Magic is quite brief. I would have wished it to be longer, but it's there. And, you know, and part of this is the magician of the 19th century is somebody who has connections to the other world. There's something mystical and magical about what a magician does, whereas the vaudeville magician is somebody of great skill. There's somebody who's dexterous. There's somebody who has card tricks or who knows how to do things that you could learn yourself, right? That it's not that somehow they've sold their soul to the devil and they now have these mystical powers. They're just an extremely talented person who has learned how to do magic. And it even becomes a practice in some vaudeville acts for the magicians to show the audience how they did it. And that I think captures this notion of the ordinary person on stage or the person playing themselves on stage.
And one of the things I think that you argue that I find particularly interesting is in some ways that double relationship, that it's both people representing themselves as ordinary people on stage and also being the products of, in some ways, the cutting edge of modern show business, is one of the things that makes vaudeville so influential on people's daily lives, that they are kind of pitching themselves as a reflection of the audience to a certain extent, but actually they're demonstrating a set of new ways of being to that audience.
Yes, that's right. And you see this a lot in the offstage, often potted interviews that are made with performers. They're always trying to naturalize themselves and become as ordinary as they can. So they'll give their pot roast recipes, right? They'll talk about what they like to do on a rainy Sunday, their favorite books to read, photos are taken of their living rooms. There's this effort to make them ordinary, and yet it's all about selling their celebrity. And that's why it is a kind of democratization of celebrity in that sense. And the kind of pre-studio Hollywood does this too, right? But as you get in more into the studio era, it becomes more about creating a glamour around the artist that isolates them from ordinary people. They still become, of course, figures of emulation, but there's more of a sense of turning them into larger than life figures. Whereas vaudeville, they don't want to be larger than life. They want to be richer than anybody else. And they want to show their taste and their fondness for modern clothing, modern food, travel, fast cars, big houses. But they still want to be ordinary, right? They still want to talk about their kids and how much they enjoy going to the countryside and picking apples. So it is a kind of pre 20th century celebrity, but post 19th century stardom.
Yeah. So just to kind of situate this a little bit in this point in some of the historiography of vaudeville, one of the things I think that's really interesting about what you're saying here is I feel like the existing writing about vaudeville, there's been a real focus on respectability or non-respectability. That's been kind of like a dominant term that's kind of shaped the scholarship. And one way to view some of those, like, I'm just like anyone else stories is kind of like a, you know, a pushing back against lingering theatrical prejudice. And I was just fascinated to see this entire other explanation for it, that's so convincing.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm glad you found it convincing. Thanks for that. That's it is a somewhat novel argument in terms that it does run against some of what it does. I don't think it runs against the full gamut of what people have said about vaudeville. I think there's been a recognition of its place in modern entertainment. But I think there has been a lot of attention placed on the connection to the audience and vaudeville as a reflection of its audience. The older literature holding that it's a kind of direct reflection, so that it's an opportunity for immigrant Americans to see themselves on stage and gain a sense of acceptance into the society by seeing themselves acted out. And in the newer literature, it's almost becomes a safe space for dissent. The theater is as a form of protest where people could explore their class or their gender ambiguities and challenge the existing order. So both of those interpretations are certainly valid. They just look at different aspects of it, the ones I do. And I think probably the young historian of the future, perhaps yourself, Sam, will find a way of bringing all this together and giving us a kind of synoptic overview of the whole thing so that we can put these various aspects together, because I don't think they are mutually exclusive. I think we can see vaudeville as a modern entertainment. We can talk about stardom, but we can also talk about the other aspects of what vaudeville achieved and did.
So at the risk of adding another level of complexity to all of this, but very much to kind of continue the thread of vaudeville's modernity, I thought one of the most exciting interventions you made here, something that's been hinted at in other books on the subject, but often kind of in the peripheral vision, which is vaudeville's relationship to ragtime. And your kind of discussion of a broader culture of ragtime that really goes far beyond the handful of pianists who are typically discussed in that framework. So I'm just wondering if you could talk about a little bit about ragtime and how you see it relating to vaudeville.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, you're more of an expert on this than I am, I suspect. So please intercede and correct me if I wander off too much from the right path. I argue that, well, first, I think ragtime is neglected. I think we'd all agree on that. It was the major form of popular music in between the waltz and Victorian sentimental song, parlor song, and jazz. So it stands at an important moment of transition at the turn of the century. It itself is not well understood in terms of what ragtime is. It certainly is a more rhythmic music. The people who write it have a lot of trouble describing it. I mean, toe tapping is a kind of way that they think about it. Danceable, something that is freer and invites more audience engagement. Those are all the types of terms that are used, but with a minimum of improvisation, and something that may have been or probably was African American in origin, but very clearly becomes dominated by white musicians and composers, and becomes very much a kind of appropriated musical form, and one that is developed by white Americans as opposed to African Americans. And here it stands in contrast to jazz. So it's central not just because of chronological proximity, but because ragtime, I argue, becomes popular and becomes America's national music because of vaudeville, because of its inherent characteristics of being a kind of easy listening music, one that brings about audience engagement, one that allows for body movement on stage because of its dancing characteristics, one that puts the performer to the forefront. All of those things lend themselves naturally to vaudeville, and it's the reason that ragtime becomes the sound of vaudeville, and because it's the sound of vaudeville, I argue the sound of America during this this period. And you know, you've done work on Irving Berlin and other great composers who perfect the form. So it is a lively and mobilizing, in terms of cultural terms, form of musical expression. And it dies as vaudeville dies. So the chronology of the two are closely linked. And I think it has suffered the same neglect that vaudeville has suffered itself. That people have tended to just see ragtime as the in-between music, in between America's great contribution to 20th century popular music in jazz, and kind of a precursor of jazz without much credibility in and of itself. And you're also right that the tradition in ragtime is to link its origins not to the theater, but to the piano and to individual composers of piano music. Whereas I locate it very clearly in the theater and as vocal music. And finally, we tend to think of vaudeville in terms of the comics, but it's the singers who overwhelmingly dominate the form. A very high percentage of the acts in vaudeville are singing acts or singing and dancing acts. So that really is vaudeville's most characteristic type of music. And I think the reason for its popularity, because it's the place, it's the only place that you can go to hear live music sung. So if you want to hear in the pre-record days, if you want to hear a song, you go to vaudeville.
So one of the complexities, I think, of ragtime and its relationship to vaudeville is that, like you said, it's a African-American derived set of musical practices that continue to be understood as Black music, but that quickly expands far beyond that community and is popularized and commercialized, and much of the profits go outside of that community. And so I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit more about the connection between, I guess, ragtime's use of like racial modernity and vaudeville's modernity, mm-hmm. that some of the appeal of this seems to be, of ragtime, seems to be that it's understood as Black music, and that it allows vaudeville performers and maybe vaudeville audiences to engage in a different kind of experience.
Yeah, this is probably the most complex area. I have to admit, I don't know if I got it right. The issue of its associations with Blackness are clear, though they probably become less clear over time as ragtime comes to increasingly be associated with white performers, but certainly in the earliest period and in its earliest manifestations, there is the often the employment of African American dialect or stage dialect. It's not, nobody speaks that way, but what is associated on the stage with African American speech, there is some use of blackface, though not ubiquitous, in ragtime performance. So there is an association with blackness, and what I struggle with, and I don't know if one should admit to these things in these podcasts, but I still struggle with, right? I don't think I've got the final word on this. I'm reaching towards something, and I don't know if I fully landed it. But the issue for me is that combination of naturalization of performance, so the identification with the performer, and the use of racial masking. And how do those two coincide and work together? How can you be at once performing yourself and adopting a racial stereotype? And we see this, you know, and we see it in jazz as well, the use of a racialized symbolism or racialized code among white performers, which associates them with African Americans without them wearing blackface. Part of what I argue is that this is a somewhat pernicious thing, because these symbols, which are often stage symbols of a racial identity, are being adopted by white people and then naturalized, made part of their own performance behavior. So it will be talking jive or using some form of body movement that is associated with African Americans, and then blurring that association so that it becomes implicit for the audience and also implicit for the performer. And to what extent does that play a role in naturalizing racial stereotype, of perpetuating stereotypes that in the 19th century were more overtly connected to the absurdity of blackface? When you take the blackface off but do the same thing, that seems to me an even more pernicious thing, because you are making the racial characteristics that you have, as you have defined them, authentic and natural. And that's kind of what I grapple with. And I don't even know if I expressed it well in the book itself. It was what was troubling me about all of this. And the way in which those stereotypes were being used to bring out the personality and the identity of the performer more sharply. So you see this with, I mean, when listeners will recognize it, Al Jolson, right? Nobody would take Al Jolson as black. His black face is so transparently painted on. And his singing is so clearly that of a New York Jewish person, right? And he sings songs associated with his Jewishness in blackface. And so in a sense, as others have talked about Jolson, this effort to use the blackface to enhance your own personality and your own ethnic identification with the group that you truly belong to, is another aspect of this that is troubling, because I think it does serve to perpetuate the tradition of the use of racial stereotype in order to self-express, and we see that still today in youth cultures, and also the use the naturalization or normalization of these stereotypes. And that troubles me as a person of, I hope, good faith. I grapple with it in the text. Is that am I getting that across as clearly as I hope I am?
Yeah, no, that was great. No, and really fascinating.
Yeah, it is. It's an interesting reflection to have. And you know, you think about it with the songwriters and the ethnic songwriters and their manipulation of Black or Italian stereotypical forms in order to more effectively present values or ideas that come from themselves. So you're not playing at being Jewish anymore. Now you are using Blackness to enhance Jewishness, or you're using a German identity to better enhance something American, right? And it's that layering that's so complicated that unpacking it is hard.
So clearly, vaudeville is not still around.
Right.
Variety is, and arguably TikTok is vaudeville. But that's a different story for another day, I think. Vaudeville ends by the mid-1920s. And as you kind of described, its heyday is actually for a form that is so large and so influential. Its heyday is really remarkably short. And you kind of close the book by pointing to the kind of industry forces and cultural forces that result in vaudeville's terminal and sudden decline. I was wondering if you could just tell us a little bit about that.
Yep, sure. I mean, you know, it's not absolutely true, of course, because vaudeville continues into the 1940s and there are still vaudeville performers who are performing in theaters. But vaudeville in the classic sense of an evening of entertainment that is devoted to live acts that are presented sequentially in chains of theaters using a particular form of distribution, that disappears by the mid-1920s. And what you increasingly have are individual performers who are alternated with films. They are in the silent film era largely used to break up the monotony, I would take it, of silent film. That you, even though I don't find silent films monotonous, I love silent films, but you know what I mean. You have speaking, you have singing, you have some comedy in between the films. And so that does survive, but that's what really supplants classic vaudeville by the mid 1920s. The reasons for its collapse are complicated. I think for any industry that is at the top of its game, remaining there is going to be hard, particularly as competition increases. And what you see over the course of the early 1920s is increasing competition not only from cinema, but from nightclubs, dancing, speakeasies in the era of Prohibition, the Revue, the growth of the musical theater and the traveling musical theater, and all of this cuts into vaudeville's market. And vaudeville had always operated on relatively slender margins. So the profits had been made out of volume. And as the volume of customers decrease, the owners of vaudeville theaters attempt to counter that by reducing the number of theaters and making them larger and larger, so that these huge, what will become the movie palaces of the 1930s, start out as vaudeville theaters. And they're extremely large, extremely opulent theaters that are replacing the neighborhood theater with centralized ones. they make that investment in the era around World War One, in the years after World War One, and it proves a very bad time to make investments because there's a market contraction in the Depression in the early 1920s, which moves a lot of the vaudeville companies that are trying to make this transition into insolvency. So some of it is that. Some of it comes from the business climate of the time, the increasing competition for entertainment. And the other part, I think, comes from the conservatism of vaudeville itself, its reliance on a stable of stars who become increasingly entrenched. And the industry finds it very hard to draw new talent. New talent is going off into nightclubs. New talent is going off into the movies and isn't really as interested in a career where every night they're performing in a different city or maybe three nights in one place and then they have to take the train to the next place. That is much less appealing than performing in a nightclub or a cabaret where you can stay put. Or going to Hollywood and performing in a movie, so that they find it difficult to draw talent. As the market contracts, they find it more difficult to pay the kind of competitive salaries for big name talent that would draw people, and they become increasingly reliant on older stars who have a cachet, of course, with long term vaudeville theater goers. But who maybe appeal less to the younger audiences that are emerging in the post-war years. So it starts looking old and it starts looking stale, and that's a bad place to be if you want to be a cutting-edge entertainment. So there are both internal reasons in terms of the types of stuff that vaudeville is featuring and also economic and business reasons why it doesn't survive. But as I point out, you know, there's a lot of the literature seems to think that this is just an inevitable thing and that vaudeville is just going to decline as movies take over because movies are so much less expensive. It's a cheaper product to put on and more pervasive than a vaudeville theaters could ever be. But it's not. Vaudeville bounces around, and 1919 is probably vaudeville's most profitable year, and that's a year when the film industry is growing massively. So it's not necessarily the case that film alone kills vaudeville. There are a bunch of factors that contribute to its demise.
Well, I mean, I think, like I said, I think this is a really fantastic book that does so much to kind of take this form and really place it in the center of a lot of the complex dynamics of America and in the progressive era at the turn of the century. And I really want to thank you for your time.
Well, thank you, Sam. It's really good to talk to you and to meet you. And I really look forward to reading your work. I think it's going to be groundbreaking. And it is going to move us to a whole new level of interpretation. So from one vaudevillian to another, thank you for this interview and thank you for the work that you're doing.
Thank you so much.